All right, up until this point, we've heard some really excellent presentations from current researchers who have been able to really be able to demonstrate why it's important to be considering these social stressors in environmental health. We've heard how one particular state and state agencies are beginning to maybe better address these issues by looking at cumulative impacts. And what I'd like to share with you is an update from a symposium that the US EPA and some other outside partners hosted back in March, where the issue of cumulative risk or cumulative impacts, social vulnerability, certainly were discussed and were a big topic at this meeting. And it's another way to sort of share with you what the participants at this meeting, people representing environmental justice organizations and community organizations, were saying to EPA about what needs to be done. I also want to just point out, and I want to acknowledge that both Amy Kyle and Rachel Morella-Frosch were speakers at our meeting, and I just want to acknowledge that and say thanks again. Okay, here's the disclosure. But I also just want to point out that what I have to say are my own personal opinions and don't represent official EPA policy. I just wanted just to remind ourselves and other colleagues that, you know, the EPA mission is quite broad, and it is to protect human health and the environment. And there are a whole series of activities that the agency engages in to carry out this mission, from the development of the scientific bases for decisions, conducting research, developing methods for analysis, methods for assessment, collection of data, and this information then is fed into a regulatory or policy-making process. And along that line, at some points, there are opportunities for public comment, but oftentimes that is conducted in sort of a one-way approach. And then once a regulation is perhaps developed or policy is developed, of course, there's the phase of implementation. One aspect of that could be the issuance of permits. That's also another opportunity where a lot of the public are most familiar with in terms of opportunities for public comment and intervention. And then, of course, there's the work along to make sure that those permitted facilities or industries or parties are complying with those permits and regulations, their inspections, there are maybe enforcement actions. And all along those this continuum, there's also perhaps looking at the issue of cost-benefit analyses, as well as a review by the Office of Management and Budget. And then down the line, we will see impact at the community level. But we have something called the Executive Order on Environmental Justice. This executive order is still in place, thankfully. But it suggests that all along that continuum of activities that the EPA is engaged in, we need to be considering environmental justice considerations throughout that whole continuum. And I just am showing you an excerpt from that executive order, which actually makes it a requirement on all federal agencies to consider and identify disproportionately high and adverse human health or environmental effects on minority and low-income populations that may result from their programs and policies and activities and take actions to address these disparities. And, you know, as you've heard from our presenters earlier, as well as other work that have gone on well before today, you know, there is mounting evidence of these disproportionate impacts. It's just continuing to build. It's already been demonstrated that population groups that experience systematic social disadvantage do bear a disproportionate impact. And these impacts are not random. These things are not happening in a random way. There are patterns to these impacts, and they're linked to decisions. And these decisions include, as some things that Amy had discussed or mentioned, things around land use planning and zoning, resource extraction, community development, investment and banking practices, which also have some relationship in influencing then the work of our environmental agencies and how we are looking at information to inform our decisions about permitting, setting environmental quality standards, and how we go about our enforcement. So, despite all the accumulation of evidence, really at the federal EPA, there really has been a lack of a sort of a consistent approach to considering these issues in our decision-making processes. This is not just me saying this. I mean, there have been several reports to this effect. We have a GAO report several years ago that made this statement, as well as our own Inspector General. So as a result, this sort of led to a motivation to organize a symposium around how best we could better incorporate environmental justice concerns in our decision making. And I worked very hard with a wonderful colleague of mine at EPA, Onyemaechi Nweke, who I think might be in the audience. And this is sort of our central motivation for putting this meeting on, and which was really to lay the groundwork for developing a systematic and scientifically defensible approach for incorporating these concerns in EPA's decision-making processes. And I just highlighted a couple quotes that she's even shared with me from her work in the Office of Environmental Justice of the kinds of questions that come up from the different program offices within EPA. They may be staff in the air office or the water office, you know, who seem to just be at a loss to think about these things. How do you identify disproportionately impacted population groups or communities? How can we translate these kind of concerns into what we need to do? And I have to say, albeit it is still sort of within that very narrow framework of risk assessment. So here's the graphic from our meeting, and that's the URL for you all to access the background documents, some of the program materials. I also want to point out that we held two pre-symposium webinars leading up to the meeting. One was on the use and interpretation of race in environmental health research, what does or could it mean? And also we had a presentation about how within EPA and the different program offices our environmental justice, how is environmental justice program implemented at the agency? So I invite you to check out that URL. I just wanted to give you a little bit of overview of the structure of the meeting. We had basically three themes, where our first theme was to look at the understanding the state of the science of the contributors to disproportionate impacts. Another theme was to understand policy and decision-making frameworks that could be used to better incorporate these considerations, as well as looking at what are the research and science needs. And with regards to understanding the contributors and the state of the science, we had commissioned seven papers around seven topic areas. I don't know if you can really read them from where you're sitting, but these were factors that were previously identified by the Office of Environmental Justice as contributing to disproportionate impacts. And they're not unusual. I mean, these are things probably all of you are quite familiar with. The issue around proximity to environmental hazards, the issue of the multiple and cumulative exposures and impacts, issues around unique exposures, issues around population vulnerability, susceptibility, issues around the conditions of the physical infrastructure, community capacity to participate in decision making, and a later addition to this list was the issue of psychosocial stress. And in the discussions about the state of the science, we also had poster sessions where people were invited to come and present how one or more of these concepts had been applied in a particular example, looking at data and assessment or analytical approaches. With regards to informing policy and decision making, we had several sessions about EPA's current frameworks for making decisions. So we had sessions on risk assessment, on the legal frameworks, on economic analysis, as well as we wanted to explore some different ways of thinking. So we had a session on health impact assessment, and that's certainly becoming a novel way of thinking about things and a growing interest in how that approach could be applied to decision making, as well as we had some people speaking about some work at different health departments where people have been able to develop something they call equity screens, so being able to look at equity impacts of decision making. And then we had sessions to talk about, well, what are the data gaps, what are the research needs, and hopefully laying sort of a groundwork for then what the agency needs to do to fill those gaps. I just want to share with you some my own observations about the meeting. It was quite interesting. We had, I think, maybe up to 300 participants, and we also had sort of the similar number of people linking in by way of a webcast. We had a very mixed audience. We had EPA staff there, EPA risk assessors, academics. We had individuals representing different community-based organizations, environmental justice organizations, social scientists, students, public health policy people, other governmental agencies, and private foundations. And I just want to share that there were some challenging moments with this very, very mixed audience. And it was, you know, a balancing act to figure out how do we address the needs of all these different parties. But I think it was really important that we were able to have such a diverse audience because, you know, we could all learn from each other. With regards to some of the observations I've listed here for you, that we noticed that there's sort of a huge disconnect between what some of the individuals representing community-based organizations know about what EPA does and understand that there are all these other activities well upstream before the more visible activity like a permit issuance or an enforcement action, but also that EPA lacks understanding about what policy and regulations and regulatory actions are or are not working on the ground. We also heard a lot of comments about how states matter, state governments, state agencies, in that, you know, EPA could do all these wonderful things to make a terrific policy or regulation, but really, you know, I don't know if you realize, but a lot of our programs are delegated to states, and that really it's up to them in the implementation of that. States can make or break an EPA's good intentions, perhaps. We also heard a lot about the need for more holistic impact. There's the word impact assessment methodologies, particularly with regards to cumulative impacts. Being able to better understand the joint effects of the social and physical environmental conditions. There was discussion again about being able to understand equity, so that also equity impacts or those outcomes, which speaks to, you know, being able to use or borrow from the social science literature about different metrics of inequality. And that the EPA needs to engage more with the public and community-based organizations about getting their thoughts and inputs into our research agendas. So with regards to the topic of cumulative impacts, these are some of the more specific recommendations and issues that came up at the meeting on this topic. For one, people really were obviously overemphasizing the need to move away from the single chemical approach to being able to address multiple factors in places related to the environment when addressing public health issues. A number of people actually recommended that we should pay more attention to the WHO report on social determinants of health and how that might be actually a better framework for us to think about dealing with multiple stressors and cumulative impacts, what needs to be done, how to conceptualize these issues. Also, some participants advocated that we should, let go this idea of acceptable, letting something called acceptable risk be a barrier to reduce hazards anyway. Also, they pointed out that we should be aware of all the other stressors that the people, populations, communities are experiencing in relation to this, maybe the specific stressor that the EPA might be particularly looking at, say, if it's within the context of a water quality standard, an air quality standard. Think about those things that are being left out, but you have to address them. That there was some criticism that there's an over-reliance, that we tend to over-rely on quantitative measures, quantitative approaches, that we need to open ourselves up to more qualitative approaches. And then also the comments have been made about that the issue about what to do about cumulative impacts or risks seems to be more of a policy problem or a political will problem than a research problem. I mean, I think you've already heard from our presenters earlier that, look, we have the tools. We have the knowledge, but are we willing to do something about it? And then further, there was comments about maybe thinking about our broader definition of health in that think about health more holistically, and instead of coming at health from a sort of a negative perspective, that we should be thinking and asking about, well, what needs to be done to promote health and shift our focus away from measuring the negative but more towards understanding the positive, what's needed for the positive aspects of health and life and well-being instead of illness and death. So just to share with you some next steps, there are some. Currently, EPA staff and myself and my colleague Meichi and Weke from OEJ, we are reviewing all the recommendations from the symposium and looking at developing actions that we can take to address each one of them. And we're going to be putting all this information into a report. We're calling it the 100-Day Challenge Report. There's a long story to that. But in any case, the idea is that we would put this together and helpfully issue this at the beginning of early 2011. But I just wanted to share with you some individual actions that people are considering. We noticed some themes popping up in looking at all the recommendations, and those are the four big bullet points there. We saw recommendations that seem to fall along the lines of policy needs and issues about addressing the decision-making process. At EPA, we certainly saw a lot of recommendations around science and research needs. We saw some recommendations around actions we could take to really be promoting healthy and sustainable communities and issues around capacity building. So with regard to policy and decision-making processes, I can tell you at least one thing has already happened, but there's some additional work behind it. The agency has developed a guidance for EPA staff to incorporate environmental justice concerns in its rulemaking processes, but it's more of a process guidance about when to be thinking about these things, the kinds of questions to ask, but the issue is about how. And so there's a demand for a more technical guidance, so to speak, about how to actually maybe recast the different assessments that need to be done and how to interpret that information and how to present it to the decision maker. So there is work going on to develop such technical guidance. Around the science and research, within the office that I sit in, which is the Office of Research and Development, there is an effort to look at breaking down the silos of our different research programs our research programs in a more integrated, interdisciplinary approach, and where we would explicitly put environmental justice and equity concerns on the table as an important issue to address, even in our research, to be informative, to actions to address and bring equity. Around healthy, sustainable communities, there's a new initiative that was announced, I guess, earlier this fall between HUD and EPA and DOT. Although the focus is more on economic development, but still this is this idea of, collaboration across federal agencies that's important. We certainly heard a lot of critique about that there seems to be a lack of the different agencies talking to each other and working together instead of, off doing their own thing. On capacity building, I want to point out that oftentimes people think, the community-based organizations or the communities need to develop technical capacities to deal with their own problems. But I want to point out that in EPA, we also need to develop our own capacity, capacity around how we engage with the public in a more equal partnership kind of way. Also, there with regards to scientific approaches, we're mainly staffed by toxicologists, engineers, etc., whereas the kinds of issues that are being brought up here really require some different expertise and different understanding. And so one of the things that's been brought up is that we really do lack social science expertise, and we need to do something about that. And I see that as an issue of building capacity within EPA to bring in that expertise. And then what I point out here in one of these bullets is that within the EPA, there are efforts to better train or better inform EPA staff on how to interact at the community level. And I put out here this Community University Institute, although that's mainly targeted at, say, Superfund staff, that's like a different, one program within EPA, maybe it's possible to look at those already existing resources and maybe tailor them a little bit to be more applicable to the other different programs at EPA. So with that, I'd like to say thank you, and I'll see if there's any question for me, but then I want to get into a dialogue about how do we actually move forward on this, honestly. So come up. If Amy and Rachel, if you guys come up. Is there any way to turn the lights up? While we're moving around. Is there a question?
Well, I guess
Go ahead.
No, I had a question for Dr. Rosh.
Lights up, up.
I know the scope of the research is to look at social determinants and community determinants and adverse growth outcomes, but how do you deal with the challenge of environmental co-founders, like disinfection byproducts or smoking?
We haven't really, you mean disinfection byproducts in water? That's what you're...
Yeah, it can also lead to the same for that.
Yeah. So we don't really have the ability in terms of our data to look at that particular question. The smoking issue, it's actually kind of an interesting one because California doesn't do a very good job of collecting smoking data right now in its birth registry. So it's not very dependable. However, some colleagues that I've worked with, I didn't work on this particular analysis, but there have been efforts to look at how much smoking actually affects any pollution health outcome relationships in other data sets where there's much better smoking data collected. And what it actually shows is that smoking is actually not that much of a, doesn't really confound or change the effect estimates, at least for where they were able to do that kind of analysis. And if you think about it, you know, from a theoretical standpoint, smoking obviously has a very profound effect on birth outcomes, but its effect as a confounder, because its independent relationship to outdoor air pollution, from a theoretical standpoint, there's no reason to think that you would see that sort of independent relationship. So it's not that surprising that it's not really that strong of a profound in terms of air pollution birth outcome relationships.
Okay. Sure.
When you had the map of LAF on your study, I noticed this lovely grid pattern. You couldn't help but bring them on the roads. Are those major corridors?
There, a component of that were emissions related to roads, so that would be part of the cumulative metric that we have, so yes.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I guess this is for everybody. I guess my question is for like environmental justice communities. And it seems like the data's been there, the tools are there, the ways to measure, you know, NEJAC was saying it, environmental justice communities are identifying cumulative impact and living cumulative impacts. So I guess it's kind of when are we going to be willing to do something? And how do EJ communities really have faith? And you know, EPA, for example, has done a terrible job of investigating Title VI complaints that EJ is really going to be something that is paid attention to. And I guess maybe you guys can talk about how your work is impacting those policy decisions at the local or state level. And then EPA, you know, what do you see moving forward and that political courage to be able to do work with them?
I'd like to take a shot at that. The motivation for what I presented with you starts in the city of Camden. There's a census tract, it's called Waterfront South. In South Camden, there are 8 metal recyclers, there is a municipal incinerator, there is a cement manufacturer, and this is actually one of the poorer places in the city of Camden, where the city of Camden already is a very poor place. They filed a suit with New Jersey EPA to basically block the permitting of additional emissions at the cement factory. And they won that suit at a district court level and had that overturned by the Supreme Court. Basically, where it's the Supreme Court took away Title VI as being a tool. Now, what this struck me was that they've emasculated the legal processes to protect vulnerable populations, but which indicated to me that the point was that we needed to define what a vulnerable population actually is. Politically, you can get people in a room to figure out what a disparate impact is. So it's really more about political will. But when you put this in the context of economy, you put this in the context of a capitalist economy of where businesses are coming together and competing and so on. you don't have a political consensus. You know, so I think that you've got to strengthen analytical tools to actually say unequivocally, this is what differential exposure is. This is what a vulnerable population is. And by the way, here's the boundary of what it looks like. So that unequivocally you can see that this is unfair, this is unconscionable. So that you can try to channel outrage and political process into, you gotta merge the political process with some kind of a scientific framework and bring the two together to really step up the tension on increasing, getting the attention of leaders to actually take action.
Amy, Rachel, oh.
I would just make a brief comment, which is, well, you never have faith in agencies, right? Because they're political actors operating in a political context. And
yeah.
Sometimes they do good things and sometimes they do bad things. So I think that's sort of the wrong question. But I respect where you're coming from here is what will push this in the right direction. And I think this is a scientific session, right? So, we're not talking about everything here. We're talking about some pieces of it. But there's part of it that's changing this sort of scientific norm of how we do assessment, how we think about making decisions that we could do. People in this room could change this norm away from one thing at a time, and we're not really going to think about reality, which is the way it is now. So that's not the whole answer. There's a political side to that, too. Everything that's happened has happened as a result of political organizing. I know that, I honor that. But that's not exactly the focus, what this meeting was about.
You have a question?
Yeah, it's a question, but more of a comment. I happen to chair the EJ board for the Department of Environmental Protection in the state of Pennsylvania. And we deal with these kinds of issues all the time. And the political process works, it doesn't work. The definitions of what an EJ community is, doesn't rise easily to definitions. Every individual permit, the permittee is saying, look, I meet all the regulations. So, I think we're looking at this completely the wrong way around. And one of the things that we managed to do as an advisory board, it certainly hasn't been adopted as how to do regulation, is to take a look at something called precautionary principle. And adopt that, which puts it the other way around. Before you can add something into the community, you've got to show that it isn't going to add to the harm, rather than us always having to respond and carrying out science and, quote, proving things to people that they don't want to have particularly proven. And so what's the thought about, turning the whole system back around and saying, let's use a precautionary principle that you can't impact the community more if it's already been badly impacted.
Well, there's something I want to share as a comment. I don't know if the panelists, my friends here, would care to comment on this, but there's a lot of hand-wringing, as I was describing to Amy, at EPA, oh my gosh, how do we do cumulative, risk assessment? How do we do this? How do we do this? We can't do anything until the science is right. But there's been a lot of talk and effort, around getting the science right. But I don't think there's not enough energy being directed at, what are those legal barriers, as well as the political barriers to finally actually doing something about cumulative impacts. I mean, I need to point out that while we've shared these ideas with colleagues in different parts of EPA, some people will say, the statute doesn't really allow me to think about these things, for example. And I've heard of court cases where people have brought up, baseline exposures, sort of getting at, aren't I already overburdened? Don't add any more to my community, where the court won't even consider that. I'm just kind of curious if you guys have any reaction to what are some ways to overcome those? It's not the science.
No, I think it's the political process, really. But I mean, that doesn't really answer the question, because it really gets to how do you stimulate a political process. I come back to South Camden. To some folks, getting 50, 60 jobs that are really good paying jobs they'll fight for that. I mean, it's one thing to say, boy, you know, we ought to just stop this level of exposure, but you've got 41% of the households living below the federal poverty level. You know, some other folks are saying, we need economic growth. And so, it's very hard to tell a community that, you know, we're going to stop this exposure, but we're going to keep you poor in the process, you know, that we can't have any additional industry. Of course, then it goes to what's sustainable industry. But
and who gets the jobs?
And who gets the jobs? But look, that's a private enterprise. I mean, that's a market that's either there or not there. And I think that it's really more of a market problem that you know, than a governmental problem.
Rachel?
Well, I was just going to say that I think one of the most important things to keep in mind is that I think dovetailing on what Amy said is communities aren't just relying on agencies to fix things for them. They're taking a lot of proactive action, and I think one of the best examples in leveraging science in ways and tools for decision-making in ways that advance their goals to improve the health of their communities. So I think one of the best examples is a lot of the community efforts that are going on now around climate change, implementation of climate change legislation. So I'm fortunate enough to be from California, where we just pushed back an effort to roll back our climate change legislation. And so we have a lot of work before us in terms of how we're going to do that and how we ensure that environmental justice concerns are integrated in that. A lot of EHA organizations have been involved from the beginning and trying to ensure not just about issues about siting and pollution and toxics, but how are we going to ensure that any revenues generated from a climate change legislation get invested in ways that address the environmental justice concerns of communities? And what's the process by which we're going to identify those communities? And what are the tools that exist that we can use to begin to identify what we call, you know, what has been deemed, you know, climate gap neighborhoods or climate justice neighborhoods, to think about not only just dealing with toxics and targeting greenhouse gas reductions where pollution is the worst, but also targeting some of the investments to remove neighborhoods that have been very dependent on fossil fuel jobs, fossil fuel intensive jobs, more towards green jobs.
Can we have a question? We roll back the clock. When Applebank was dealing with smoking and how long it took the scientists to convince the government to make them damn cigarette companies put on a package that it'll kill you. What happened in that process to have the scientific community and the government agencies to finally say lighting a cigarette is going to put you in the grave and we want that put in the package? Now, I don't know how long that took. I don't know how many sessions of Congress, how many judges were thrown out before that happened. But what lessons can we learn with EJ from that period of time? It took, 40 years to get the packages to be printed and disappeared. I don't know how we can do that today, but certainly EPA all look at that collaboratively, because it took forever to do that. And the last point I'd like to make is, I know you guys from California love to see great erudite academics in California. We got black colleges in the South that need some of this money that you all have gotten to deal with the issues in black communities, where most of the pollution, most of the Cubans, effects are killing black folks. And yet these colleges are sitting there closing, not recruiting scientific students and minds to deal with the issues that you guys are dealing with. Get adamantly, but y'all ain't in the South and y'all ain't black. So we need to get some money from EPA to get some of these epidemiologists in the black hospitals in the South, and particularly in places like Nashville, Tennessee, with four black colleges, one being Meharry Medical College. Yeah. So we that's another part of that stakeholder capacity building we'd like the EPA to get serious about.
Pull with a lot of hands. Ms. Gwen.
So I've gone to a number of these environmental justice meetings over the year that are around this issue of what research is necessary.
Say who you are.
Oh, I'm Gwen Coleman from the National Institute of Environmental Homeland. Talking about what the research needs are in the future, it's still not clear to me what data, what research, what's really needed, and how that plays into any of the changes in the rule making that EPA is proposing. I know it's a work in progress, but I think it would be really effective to know, are we talking about know, observational data at the community level. Because if we want to support research, and that's the research that's going to carry all the weight, then that should match what the ultimate goals are. If it's to develop, you know, broad, high-level, you know, modeling, then, and that's what the process is going to value, then we should put our monies in that. If it's, you know, developing new tools for biomonitoring, then maybe the, you know, imperative is to have a different kind of nationwide biomonitoring program. But it's not clear to me, and I'm in a position to try to figure out the priorities of where research dollars would go, what where the best bang for the buck would be. And if research is not needed, you know, your point that, you know, how much money do you need to put into proof, again, what we pretty much know, then should those dollars move into action at the local level so that you can really assist the evolution of the problems, both at the local or regional level. And so I would love to hear what people think about which of the types of research, if any, are necessary and how they will be really valued within the rulemaking process.
As Michi, would you want to say anything? Yes.
So I would like to talk a little bit about what my name is.
I would just say, you know, Gwen, that I think everything that you named is needed, frankly. And I think you have to think about what that information is important at the sort of national scale level, which is what Michi and I are talking about, as well as work that is going on at a regional level, and also building capacity at our state and local agencies as well, and information that then communities or organizations can use to further advance what they're working on. So I don't think it's just one thing. I think it's multiple things, and I think they all have to happen at different levels. But back, I just want to say one thing on the smoking. I mean, that was a political struggle. You know, I mean, that information, the science about the relationship between smoking and health was well known. But all along those way, those other interests, those in business interests, were fighting that the whole way. So it is about a combination of strategies, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, and maybe this gets to both these points, that you know, in terms of research that's needed, we need to have a better way of seeing the solutions too. You know, so much of our environmental health research is on the problem side, and it's harder to even see the solutions that are working, pull that information out. There's technical solutions, institutional solutions, legal solutions in some cases, and then organizing sorts of solutions.
Yes.
All of them have a role to play here.
Yes.
But we have very little capacity either to develop any of that further or to understand what it is we all collectively know right now. And it seems like that would be an area for investment. That also sort of gets to this point about tobacco. It was the legal side and the social norm side both changing and influencing each other. And this is going to have to be the same thing. We're going to have to develop sort of the legal, regulatory, that sort of side, but it's also a change in social norms, that we're not going to have this in these communities anymore. And one of each of those supports the other. And I think that was what we learned from tobacco.
Peggy?
Yeah, I wanted to just comment on the issue of political will and the comment that Rachel made about the climate justice movement and energy. One problem out of California has been that the EJ community has had to fight the mainstream environmental community. I think it's very interesting that I suspect there are very few, if any, environmental mainstream organizations at a conference like this, and that you rarely see them in these circles. We try to work with mainstream environmental groups, and when we have tried to insert information about public health and the impact on communities of color in climate legislation, they oppose it. And they say, that's clean air stuff. The Clean Air Act should take care of all the co-pollutant issues and all of the other impacts that you're having on your community. So they don't understand the science, clearly. Mm-hmm. But they are the ones that have the most resources to be in our state capitals and in Congress and are really influencing. Of course, they haven't been able to do it successfully on climate, but they're the ones who really influence, to a large extent, regulation other than industry and legislation. And the environmental justice community does not have the resources to be in Washington and to stay in those state houses to do that. But clearly, the mainstream environmental community is a major obstacle as well.
Wow. One last question. Mickey.
My name is Mickey Sheets, and I'm on a small policy at a small college. I'm also a member of the New Jersey Environmental Justice Alliance, and I work with Peggy on climate change issues. But I wanted to share with you some, Devin, you said, what are the legal aspects? I'm a scientist and a lawyer, and I wanted to respond to that. Our alliance in New Jersey, and it includes folks from work like South Jersey. We have three strategies. One is we're tied to a cumulative impact, so we're moving forward on our own. And the way we're going to move forward is that we develop a municipal ordinance that incorporates the cautionary principle and calls for cumulative impact assessment for any new development or new environmental hazard that's going to come into a city. And that applies back municipal-wide. And then on a ward-by-ward basis, by neighborhood, we want to give the residents of neighborhoods the right to have a referendum on any new project coming to your neighborhood. Now, this has been a legal discussion for a long time. I also organize EJ Attorney's Group in the Northeast, and we're going to vet the municipal ordinance with EJ Attorney's Group and with Land Use Attorneys in New Jersey, and we're going to develop the best legally defensible municipal ordinance we can, and then we're going to go to municipality and try to get that. But we're also working with DEP. We're going to try to convince them to include cumulative impacts in some way in their permits. And to their credit, they have developed a cumulative impacts tool. Mm-hmm. I think partly, largely, they are moaning, groaning. And we're going to try to find a way to incorporate that kind of thing, too. And we're going to do the best we can.
Right. I just want to say we're running out of time. The new groups are coming in. I just want to give another round of applause to our speakers. Thank you all. If you guys have individual questions, you might want to just...